Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Driving Machine, A Design History of the Car, by Witold Rybczynski, narrated by Lyle Blaker. Money may not buy happiness, but I'd rather cry in a Jaguar than on a bus. Françoise Sagan. Preface. Stanley Donen's 1967 film, Two for the Road, uses a series of cars to trace the rise of a couple's fortune. A hitchhiking Albert Finney is given a lift in a Volkswagen bus and meets Audrey Hepburn. Married, they tool around southern France in an old MGTD. The sports car self-destructs and they graduate to a red Triumph Herald convertible, ending up in a splendid white Mercedes 230 SL Roadster. The film made an impression on me, because Finney plays an architect, like me, and I too have a soft spot for cars. Car design and architectural design have similarities. Both are concerned with balancing the various and sometimes conflicting demands of function, construction, and aesthetics. Yet there are significant differences. An architect has to decide how to deal with what Frank Gehry once called the burden of history, whether to honor the past or ignore it. Car design is not like that. Once the link to the horse-drawn carriage was broken, which happened early, there was no preordained model. A car could be whatever you wanted it to be, boxy or streamlined, two-door or four-door. It could have four wheels or three. The automobile created its own mutating tradition. For decades, the front grille, which masked the radiator, was an identifying feature. Think of the Rolls-Royce Temple, the BMW Double Kidney, or the Volvo Slashed Bar. Then, with the electric car, the grille abruptly disappeared. Building design has many conventions. Front doors open inward. Corridors have standard dimensions. Closets are 2 feet deep. Car design is less constrained. The engine can be in the front or the back, or in the middle. Gear shifters can be on the floor, on the steering column, or sticking out of the dash. Bumpers can be exposed or concealed. Doors can swing open, slide, or even lift. Although some early cars had steering tillers, the wheel has persisted. But for how much longer? Some manufacturers have experimented with unconventional steering yokes, though so far without great success. Not that buyers aren't open to innovation. Unusual cars such as the VW Beetle, Fiat Cinquecento, and Mini have been bestsellers. But buyers can also reject designs, as they did with the Chrysler Airflow, the Henry J, and the Ford Edsel. Car makers realized early that form did not simply follow function. Automobile design was highly technical, but it also required an artistic sensibility. Enter the stylist, and inevitably, fashion. There have been automotive Baroque periods when chrome ruled, and minimalist eras when chrome disappeared. As in architecture, aesthetic sensibility and engineering demands have been tempered by changing tastes. Cars, unlike buildings, have a relatively short life. In most states, a 25-year-old vehicle is eligible for an antique license plate. Buildings, on the other hand, last for centuries. You can still walk into the lobby of the Chrysler Building on Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, but you will not find a Chrysler Airflow parked on your street. To see this car, you have to go to a car museum or a classic car show. Thus, old cars recede from memory. If they survive at all in the public's imagination, it is thanks to movies. The 1934 Ford V8 Coupe in the gruesome final scene of Bonnie and Clyde. The stately 1940 Buick Phaeton Limited convertible that takes Rick and Ilsa to the airport in Casablanca. Or the 1981 DeLorean in Back to the Future. Cars are machines, but like buildings, they are also cultural artifacts. The earliest automobiles often conveyed national traits. The down-to-earth Morris Minor, the no-nonsense Mercedes, the charming Fiat Topolino, the stylish Citroën DS. Since the 1980s, the best-selling vehicle in the United States has not been a car at all, but the Ford F-Series pickup truck, a distinctive American vehicle that deserves its own design history. Like buildings, automobiles reflect cultural preoccupations and fashions. Many cars of the 30s, such as the magnificent Czech Tatra and even the humble Volkswagen, were influenced by the Art Deco movement. The 1948 Jaguar XK120 inaugurated a new glamorous era in car design. By the 50s, the influence of aeronautics appeared in cars as disparate as the Saab 92 and the gloriously finned 1957 Imperial Crown. Such great old cars deserve the same serious attention that we give to great old buildings. They are design achievements and an important part of our material past. Over 5 decades, I've owned 15 cars. Despite my frequent buying, I refuse to call it a compulsion. I wasn't one of those people who identified with their car. For me, it was more like a tool. But I did care about design. Using a well-designed tool, whether it was a Peugeot pepper mill, a DuPont fountain pen, or a Contax II camera, provided its own pleasures. A good tool is like a natural extension of the body, a kind of prosthesis. Somebody, usually many somebodies, has refined the tool until it does its job near perfectly. The driving machine and its controls are the result of more than a century of trial and error. The foot pedals, the gear shift lever, the instrument cluster, the rearview mirror, everything is in its place. Using a well-designed tool, I feel connected to the past. Whether I am swinging a hammer, a tool of ancient Roman origin, or sitting behind a steering wheel. Chapter 1. Starting the Car. Well, sometimes Ludvinka looked over my shoulder, and sometimes I looked over his. Ferdinand Porsche on designing the Volkswagen. My first car was a Volkswagen Beetle. The design was already 30 years old, 7 years older than I, and production would continue for another 36 years, making it the world's longest-running automobile model. I bought mine in January 1967. After college, I'd worked and saved my money, and as many young architects had done before me, I set out on a European grand tour. My VW was 7 years old, bought for $300 in Hamburg, where the freighter on which I had booked passage from Quebec City berthed. The car carried me and a friend, without a hitch, from Paris to Valencia, where it was stolen, but that's another story. 900 miles. I'd never driven a VW, but the controls were simplicity itself. The enameled metal dashboard was dominated by a large speedometer that included an odometer, 3 warning lights, blue for the high beams, red for the generator, and green for low oil pressure, and an indicator for the flashing turn signal lights, which by 1960 had replaced the original semaphore indicators. There was no temperature gauge, because the engine was air-cooled. There was no gas gauge either. When the engine stuttered, it meant the tank was empty, which required flipping a lever below the dash to access the reserve, about a gallon, good for roughly 40 miles. The dashboard included 2 unidentified white plastic pull knobs. The one on the left controlled the headlights, on the right, the windshield wipers. I believe that there was also a choke. The turn signal was controlled by a stock on the steering column, and the headlights were dimmed by depressing a floor switch. There was an ashtray, although no lighter. A knurled knob on the floor beside the stick shift controlled the heat, which came from an exchanger surrounding the exhaust pipe. The first time I stopped for gas, I looked in vain for the gas cap. I found it under the hood, which was actually a trunk, since the engine was in the rear. I was reminded of my old VW the other day when my friend Jerry gave me a ride in his new Prius. Instead of a speedometer and traditional gauges, there was what Toyota calls a multi-information display, an LCD touchscreen swimming in icons, graphics, and numbers. The colorful array, which reminded me of a pinball machine, conveyed a range of technical information such as tire pressure and fuel consumption, as well as navigation and entertainment information and extraneous details such as time and date and whether a door was open. Somewhere there was a number indicating the car's speed. The cost of adding digital information is minimal, and I had the impression that the designers had simply piled on the bells and whistles. Perhaps that's why Jerry's owner's manual was almost 800 pages, compared to 90 for a 1960 VW, 20 pages just on operating the lights and wipers. Jerry told me his dealer offered a course for new owners on how to manage the complicated display. No doubt one got used to the busy flat screen. but I would miss the elegant minimalism of that old VW. The car I bought in Hamburg had distinctive oval German export license plates and an international registration sticker marked with a D for Deutschland. As I drove through Holland on my way to Paris, more than once when asking for directions I received dirty looks, especially from older persons for whom the wartime German occupation was a living memory. And after all, my car's godfather was Adolf Hitler himself, opening the 1933 Berlin Motor Show as the newly appointed Reich Chancellor. He had announced a national policy to motorize Germany, which, despite having invented the automobile a half century earlier, lagged other European countries in car ownership. Hitler called on the auto industry to produce an affordable people's car, a Volkswagen. The automotive engineer who would realize Hitler's vision was not a German native. Ferdinand Porsche, 1875 through 1951, was born in the small Bohemian market town of Maffersdorf, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. After the First World War, he would become a citizen of the newly created Czechoslovak Republic.
Porsche renounced his Czech citizenship in 1934 when he became a naturalized German citizen.
Young Porsche worked in his father's tinsmith shop and attended evening classes at the local Polytechnic College. The boy was fascinated by electricity and built his own generator, making the Porsche home the first in town to have electric light. At the age of 18, thanks to the recommendation of a local businessman, the precocious youngster was apprenticed to Bela Eger, a Viennese manufacturer of electrical equipment. 4 years later, Eger began a collaborative project to develop an electric automobile with Jacob Lohner & Company, an established luxury coach builder. Porsche, who had risen in the company, was charged with the design of the motor and drivetrain. At the time that Eger and Lohner started their project, it was far from clear which motive power was best suited to the automobile: steam, gas-fired internal combustion, or electricity. Many argued for steam, which had the advantage of being a tried-and-true technology. After all, James Watt's steam engine dated from 1776, and steam had been used to power tractors, omnibuses, and fire trucks since the mid-19th century. Not only were steam engines safe and reliable and mechanically straightforward, but steam could be produced by burning kerosene, which, unlike gasoline, was widely available. One of the pioneers was the Frenchman Amédée Bolli, 1844 through 1917, whose steam-powered omnibus, called L'Obéissante, the Obedient One, could carry 12 passengers. In 1873, Bolli demonstrated its effectiveness by driving from his native Le Mans to Paris. It took him 18 hours to make the 150-mile journey, with stops for meals, for replenishing the boiler, and not least for speeding tickets. The vehicle had a top speed of 25 miles per hour, although the fines were rescinded following Bolli's triumphant arrival in Paris. The disadvantage of a steam-powered vehicle was the heavy boiler, which needed constant attention, and the external combustion steam engine, which was considerably less efficient than an internal combustion gasoline-powered engine. What is widely considered the world's first successful internal combustion engine motor car was built by Carl Benz, 1844 through 1929, in 1885. The vehicle resembled a large tricycle. The padded bench was supported on a tubular steel frame, and the three wire-spoked wheels had solid rubber tires. A single front wheel did the steering. The two large back wheels were powered by a chain drive connected to a small one-cylinder four-stroke internal combustion engine of Benz's own design. Producing less than one horsepower and stabilized by a horizontal flywheel, the engine was sufficient to power the 600-pound vehicle at 10 miles per hour. Steering was by means of a tiller, while a hand lever applied power or brakes. There was no throttle. A knob beneath the seat adjusted the carburetor, a device that mixed air and fuel prior to combustion. The Benz patent Motorwagen went into production the following year. Sales were slow, and to help generate publicity, and without Benz's knowledge, in August 1888, his wife Bertha, 1849 through 1944, whose dowry had financed the project, drove a prototype from Mannheim, where the family lived, to her native town of Pforzheim, 65 miles away. There were, of course, no gas stations, and she stopped at a pharmacy to purchase bottles of petroleum ether, a cleaning fluid, to use as fuel. Bertha was accompanied by her two teenage sons. The historic journey took 12 hours, and on uphill stretches the boys had to get out and push. The internal combustion engine was not an overnight success. Cars powered by electric motors were quieter and simpler to build and operate, since electric motors did not require gears. The Egerlaner electric car that the young Porsche worked on was a tall four-seater, whose large wooden-spoked wheels, sprung body, and folding canvas top resembled a traditional Phaeton coach. It would be a few more years before automobile bodies assumed a distinctive form. The large rear wheels were powered by a 3-horsepower electric motor situated behind the axle, and the vehicle had a top speed of about 20 miles per hour. A box under the rear bench seat housed the batteries. Batteries were the electric car's weak spot. The Egerlaner's batteries provided a limited range, about 50 miles. Moreover, at a time when electrification was confined to cities, anyone taking a drive in the country risked getting stranded. And batteries were heavy. The Egerlaner's 74-cell lead-acid batteries added up to almost a third of the vehicle's 3,000-pound weight. That meant sluggish performance, especially when climbing hills, as well as heavy wear on the pneumatic tires. The Egerlaner electric car was one of the first automobiles in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but although 4 prototypes were built, the car did not go into production. Nevertheless, the Launer company, recognizing Porsche's obvious talent, recruited him to be the head designer of its newly formed electric car division. Earlier, when he had been working at Eger, Porsche attended an evening class at Vienna's Technical University, and to ease his bicycle commute, he built a small hub-mounted electric motor to drive the rear wheel. It was an impressive feat for a tinkering teenager. Porsche subsequently patented an electric hub motor suitable for automobiles. Driving the wheels directly with small motors reduced weight and did away with the need for a transmission, which increased efficiency. One of Launer's early electric cars was a custom-built racing car for a wealthy Englishman that used 4 hub motors, one on each wheel. The ponderous vehicle, which included a massive battery weighing almost 2 tons, has been described as a battery box on wheels. To reduce the battery size and overcome the electric car's limited range, Porsche began to work on a car whose electric motor was backstopped by an internal combustion engine, in other words, a hybrid. Each of the 2 front wheels of the 3-passenger vehicle was powered by a 2.7-horsepower electric hub motor that was connected to a 44-cell lead-acid battery, about half the size of the one in the Egerlaner car. The battery was housed in a box suspended beneath the steel chassis with shock-absorbing springs to safeguard the delicate lead plates. The battery was capable of powering the wheel hub motors for about 50 miles, at which point the driver flipped a switch that started a pair of small 1-cylinder water-cooled internal combustion engines located behind the driver's seat. The radiators were mounted on 2 sides of the front cowling. Each engine ran a generator that provided power to one of the hub motors, as well as charging the battery. Once the battery was charged, the engines could be turned off. The rudimentary dashboard had 2 dials, a voltmeter and an ammeter. A lever varied the current flow, which controlled the speed. A steering wheel controlled the front wheels. The range of the hybrid vehicle, which had a top speed of about 20 miles per hour, was effectively unlimited, and Launer named it the Semper Vivus, always alive. The ingenious Semper Vivus, which today would be called a concept car, was displayed at the 1900 Paris Exposition, where it was a public sensation and won a gold medal. Launer used the hybrid system on large vehicles such as fire trucks and buses, and also manufactured a passenger car version, although the expensive car sold primarily to wealthy enthusiasts. Porsche, a keen motor racer, built a successful hybrid racing car using hub motors on all 4 wheels. Even as the Semper Vivus was making a splash, car design was evolving. In the early 1890s, the French firm Poirot et Levasseur built several cars with front-mounted internal combustion engines driving the rear wheels. The cars used a clutch pedal and a sliding mesh gearbox. That is, the gears on the main shaft were shifted to mesh with the appropriate gears on the countershaft. This arrangement proved so successful that the so-called système polar quickly became an industry standard. One of the leading car makers at that time was Daimler Motor & Gesellschaft, or DMG, founded by the Stuttgart engineer Gottlieb Wilhelm Daimler, 1834 through 1900. Daimler and his partner, Wilhelm Maybach, 1846 through 1929, were pioneers of the internal combustion automobile. Daimler and René Pollard were friends, and DMG cars all used front-mounted engines with sliding mesh transmissions. In 1901, the German company unveiled a car commissioned by Emil Jelinek, 1853 through 1918, a DMG distributor who suggested a sportier car than the current models. Often called the first modern car, the resulting product was the work of Maybach, who was DMG's chief engineer, and Paul Daimler, 1869 through 1945, the founder's eldest son. Unlike earlier automobiles, which were influenced by carriage design and were tall and boxy, the DMG car was low and elongated, with a long hood that extended back smoothly to contain the passenger compartment. The car incorporated the first honeycomb radiator, designed by Maybach to improve cooling efficiency, and the prominent radiator grille was framed in chrome and emblazoned with the tag Mercedes, the name of Jelinek's daughter. The four-cylinder engine put out 35 horsepower, enabling the Mercedes 35 HP to reach the previously unattainable speed of 50 miles per hour. In 1906, Austro Daimler, DMG's Austrian subsidiary, which had manufactured the gasoline engines for the Semper Vivus, recruited Ferdinand Porsche to be its head designer, succeeding Paul Daimler, who had returned to Germany. Porsche stayed with the company almost two decades and eventually became managing director, overseeing the transformation of Austro Daimler into an independent company. During this time, he continued to be drawn to racing. Motor racing had developed hand-in-hand with the automobile. Races were popular with the public, and they enabled manufacturers to promote their products. The most prestigious race in Germany was the annual Prince Heinrich Tour, a 1,000-mile rally held in six stages from Berlin to Bad Homburg, near Frankfurt. It was an endurance race, limited to four-seater production cars, and the rules required drivers to be accompanied by three passengers. In 1910, Austro Daimler entered eight of its new 2780 touring cars, large four-seaters with folding tops that had been developed specifically for the rally. The cars used the Système Polar. The internal combustion engine designed by Porsche was a 5.7-liter four-cylinder that produced 95 horsepower and powered the car to an impressive 80 miles per hour. An innovation was the location of the camshaft, which converted the reciprocating motion of the pistons into rotation. Porsche moved the shaft from below the combustion chamber to above. The so-called overhead cam had fewer moving parts, produced more power, and yielded better fuel consumption. The speedy Austro Daimler touring cars placed first, second, and third, with Porsche himself driving the first-place car. The 2780, renamed the Prince Heinrich after its victory, had a distinctive one-piece body that entirely shrouded the passenger compartment and terminated in a bullet-shaped rear that contained the gas tank. The design was the work of Ernst Neumann Neander, 1871 through 1954, a German painter and graphic artist who owned an advertising agency that specialized in motor cars and motorcycles, which led him to work as a design consultant on cars and motorbikes, making him one of the first automobile stylists. The Prince Heinrich's so-called torpedo body marked an important moment in automotive design. In the dozen years that had passed since the coach-like Egerlaner car, the automobile had evolved a distinctive form, an expression not of stately motion, but of speed. The depressed post-World War I economy of the dissolved Austro-Hungarian Empire hit automobile manufacturing hard, and in 1923, Porsche left struggling Austro Daimler and joined DMG in Stuttgart. The southwestern German city, which was the home of automotive pioneers such as Daimler, Maybach, and Benz, had become the center of the German automotive industry. Porsche became DMG's technical director, again succeeding Paul Daimler, who had left after a disagreement with the board. 5 years later, DMG merged with Benz, which was the largest German car maker to become Daimler-Benz. Its cars were named Mercedes-Benz, the Mercedes being DMG's most successful model. Ferdinand Porsche was a perfectionist and not always easy to work with, and a year after the merger he had a falling out with the new management. It is unclear whether he quit or was fired, but in any case, he and his family returned to Vienna. Porsche briefly joined Steyr, an Austrian car maker, and in 1931, when the Great Depression took hold and the local economy collapsed, the peripatetic designer, now unemployed, returned to Stuttgart. This time, Porsche did not go to work for a car company. At the relatively advanced age of 56, he founded an independent consulting firm specializing in engine and automobile design. His staff included several of his Austrian and Czech engineer colleagues, as well as his son, Ferry. One of the firm's first automobile projects was the design of a budget car for Zündapp, a motorcycle company that was looking to expand into automobiles. The result was a small four-seater. Pioneering car designers such as Porsche were in uncharted waters, and as the Prince Heinrich shows, they were free to innovate. While hardly a racing car, the Zündapp T12 had a top speed of 50 miles per hour, and to improve performance, the Porsche engineers gave the car a streamlined shape with a curved front and a sloping rear. The small engine, which was air-cooled and did not require a radiator, was located in the rear, which eliminated the need for a driveshaft. Three prototypes of the Zündapp were built, but when the development costs mounted, the company got cold feet and halted the project. Later that year, NSU, a motorcycle maker that had been manufacturing cars since 1905, showed an interest in a budget car. Porsche refined the Zündapp design, giving it a curved front that complemented the sloping rear. This car, too, did not advance beyond the prototype stage. The financially strapped NSU sold its car division to Italian Fiat, which used the NSU factory to produce its own cars and shelved the Porsche design. Although the small car projects did not come to fruition, they were an important opportunity for Porsche and his colleagues to refine the principles governing a budget car, or, as a Zündapp promotional flyer had put it, ein Auto für jedermann, a car for everyone. Adolf Hitler never learned to drive. Nevertheless, he was an avid car enthusiast and was interested in racing. At the 1933 Berlin Auto Show, when he unveiled his plan to motorize the nation with an affordable small car, he also announced a state-sponsored program to make Germany the European leader in motor racing. Porsche had not forsaken his interest in racing, and his firm had developed a design for a mid-engine racing car with a teardrop shape and a powerful supercharged 16-cylinder engine. Porsche had formed a partnership with the newly founded Auto Union, the future Audi, and several months after the Berlin show, he and representatives of the company met with Hitler to seek financial support from the government. With their shared interest in automobiles and their shared Viennese background, Porsche and Hitler hit it off. Auto Union got its funding, and its racing cars, as well as those of Daimler-Benz, handily dominated the European Grand Prix circuit for the rest of the decade. The German racing cars, whose aluminum bodies were unpainted to reduce weight, became known as Silver Arrows. More important, Porsche established a rapport with the Reich Chancellor. The leading German car manufacturers were not enthusiastic about Hitler's proposed budget car, but they felt obliged to respond to his challenge, and their trade association commissioned Porsche's firm to produce a design. Hitler had provided exacting specifications. The car should accommodate two adults and three children. It should have an air-cooled engine. It should be able to maintain a cruising speed of 100 kilometers per hour, 61 miles per hour, and gas consumption should not be more than 7 liters per 100 kilometers, or 33.6 miles per gallon. Last and not least, the selling price should not exceed 1,000 Reichsmarks, about $400. The cheapest American car in 1935, a full-size Ford four-passenger sedan with a V8 engine, sold for less than $500, but that was in a country with a market that supported large-scale mass production. The least expensive German car, a small Opel, cost about 1,500 Reichsmarks, so reducing that price by one-third was going to be a challenge. Building on its previous experience with Zündapp and NSU, Porsche's team quickly produced a prototype. Ferdinand Porsche was not someone who cut corners, and thanks to his advanced engineering refinements, the final cost of the car turned out to be 1,450
Sample complete. Ready to continue?